Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. I'm Phil Taylor. And Phil Connon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil. I'm doing good.
Today we're going to talk to Tiffan Dixon, a professor at Oregon, and who is a trial counsel at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. If you do not know, the BBC Two, did a 60-minute documentary about the events in Rwanda. As this program has made it part of its business to talk about all these matters, so you're all initiated, unless you're just now listening, and I know now that's statistically probable that most of you are not regular, but welcome. Incidentally, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and of course, we're on the web, taylor-report.com. We're Facebook, taylor/thetaylorreport. Of course, we have some other matters to deal with following our discussion with Tiffan Dixon. We're going to talk about the death of Tecumseh and the War of 1812. He died on October the 5th, 1813, in weather very much like today. It was a cold day in mid-morning when the battle started at the Thames. It was a short battle, but it was horrible in terms of the consequences of its loss of people, and one of the most notable native leaders in American and Canadian history, Tecumseh, a Shawnee. So we'll talk about him. And Phil and I will be filling in, pardon it, I shouldn't have set it up so awkwardly, but we will even take up such matters as the World Series, long ball games, and such. We will have some things to say about the debate in Parliament is going on right now, or it may be over, about what Canada is going to do in the region of Iraq, Syria. We've spent a lot of time on this subject, and we intend to spend more. We will also be I'm going to call to everybody's attention, Mahdi Nazim Roya has written a very, in my opinion, excellent article about what the issues are in the so-called war with ISIS, the ISIS crisis. That you can find that at Global Post, or if you just put in Nazim Roya. But I would just urge you to go to Global. It is Global Post. Sometimes I say names and then I realize I get them wrong. Those will be the principal matters that we will take up. This program that we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, it's called the Rwanda, I think, Revisit. I'm going to get the title wrong, but at BBC Two, during the program, I will make sure I get to you the address of the, and Phil has promised to look that up, so I want you to know that. And for our guest, I'll just also mention, we're going to ask her about a new book by Barry Collins. It is published by Palgrave, and it is just freshly out, having been published in only the last week, I believe. Tiffan Dixon, who will be joining us, wrote the preface to it. The title is Rwanda 1994, The Myth of the Akazu Genocide Conspiracy and Its Consequences. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and you have to be very brave about this and be ready to pay a handsome price. But it is serious scholarship, because this issue raises so much heat and there is so much political anxiety about any matter to do with the Great Lakes region of Africa. Scholars add extra footnotes every time they publish a book because there is very strong feelings. I'm going to remind you that Tiffan Dixon was a lead trial counsel for George Rutaganda at the ICTR. And she is now an instructor at the Mark O. Hatfield School of Government, Political Science Division, Portland State University. And this book has been one of the, there's always been this discussion of where are the books, because careful people want to know what the appropriate resources are, where we should turn, and so this answers that question. And again, the titles were Rwanda 1994, The Myth of the Akazu Genocide Conspiracy and Its Consequences. For the uninitiated, I will explain that the Akazu was a notion from opposition parties within Rwanda and of the Rwanda Patriotic Front, which was fighting with the government of Rwanda. The theory was that there was a family a family conspiracy. In other words, there was a small circle of family and friends. This always develops, by the way. If you notice in the case of Syria or the case of Libya, when conflicts break out, people begin saying, well, it's just so-and-so and his family. The trick is to isolate, if possible, to bring it down to the narrowest group of people so as to bring, hopefully create a united front against them by saying, well, we're not against you, we're against so-and-so's family. For example, if you belong to the party of the president, they would say, well, we're not opposed to you. We're opposed to his family and his friends, who are, we call the Akazu. So from the beginning of the debate about what happened there, this word came in. And there was at one time a consensus that the so-called Akazu had made a plan. And everyone waited to see when the courts met whether this was going to, they were going to produce evidence to that effect. So any rate, so that's the account of the origin of the word. I think since we're going to have some time reaching Tiffin Dixon, Phil and I ought to bravely continue with other elements of the program. We might flip it over and talk about our subjects. Let's begin with me asking you, Phil. Something exciting happened in St. Louis that the world of people who follow great music ought to hear about.
Well, yes, the advent of things like the flash mob with little iPhone cameras and stuff like that opens up all kinds of opportunities for staging a demonstration. And so what happened is that the St. Louis Symphony had programmed a performance of Brahms's Requiem. I have to say, one of the most peaceful and reconciling pieces of music ever written. I mean, you couldn't think of a better choice for this little demonstration. And what happened is that about 20 members of the community who have been supporting the African-American community of Ferguson organized a little choir, quietly bought tickets, and took seats in different parts of the symphony hall. And during a break in the music, they stood up, unfurled the banner, R.I.P. Mike Brown, with his dates 1996 to 2014, and they sang to the tune of Which Side Are You On, a song about remembering Mike Brown.
Wow.
And, of course, you know, people like to say, well, this is a well-heeled audience. By the way, they had done something similar at a baseball game, and they were arrested and handcuffed and all that sort of stuff, right? And, of course, the Patriots.
But, by the way, it must have been somewhat different people, right?
Yes.
I mean, this must have been from people who were familiar with
Well, I have to say, they know how to sing. They harmonized and they followed a tune. So I don't know how many of them are
America
musicians,
wouldn't be able to sing if we didn't have black churches.
we
would all still be doing Mary'sy Dotes and Dozy Dotes.
But what was really touching was that the camera was panning the audience. And, of course, there was a loudmouth racist bigot. There was a single person who booed. One boo was heard in the whole hall, right? And then somebody sitting very close to one of the iPhone cameras made some very disgusting comments, and the guy with the iPhone camera said, we asked him to repeat it, and he wouldn't do
it. Share this with the world.
Share this thought. He wouldn't do it. But you saw, as they panned around the hall, how many people were approving and applauding, and the best part, although, again, they weren't using professional camera people and they didn't get the full value of it, was how many of the musicians on the stage applauded when they finished. They finished their little song and they furled up their banners and they left. And they were chanting Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. That was their thought.
Well,
and they went out.
That is terrific.
So on Classical Underground on Wednesday, we're going to play that two-minute video, which is available on YouTube, and we'll play some of the Brahms Requiem too to help set the mood. And we're hoping to get one of the participants on the in the and the action to come on and talk about what they did. So it's a very, very exciting event.
You think you'll be able to get someone who was actually there?
Yes, one of the participants, yeah.
So. Wow. And did you say we can tell people where they can go on YouTube and find it?
Yes. Actually, the Daily Chaos has a very, very nice write-up on it. Chaos is spelled K-O-S. This is part of the new computer age, right? If you Google Daily Chaos, you will find they posted an article on it today with the video. But I actually found it first in the Washington Post, which even they, surprisingly, were not that disrespectful of the action, although you would have expected them to have been. But even those who didn't support people doing this had a sense that this is kind of a solemn moment in for St. Louis and didn't act obstreperous. And it was very nice that, of course, that one person did, just to remind you that, you know.
Well, now, we talked about this before. Yeah. They showed up at the St. Louis Ram game.
They showed up at the St. Louis
Cardinals game. No, they're hitting.
They're hitting all the sporting
They're hitting all the sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish they'd shown up in Baltimore, yes. For the offer by that NFL franchise for people to show their rage against a black running back by returning his jersey. And I watched that. It's the sociology of YouTube, et cetera. You know, if you just say, let's not have a narrative, just show me the pictures. Yeah. Okay, I saw the picture, Baltimore stadium, football stadium. People lined up around the stadium to return their the jersey of this black football player, and everybody's white.
Yeah.
And you know something? And what I was also noted was that the people who were exchanging the jerseys, who were, by the way, it was a cheap operation. You had to really prove that you bought it from the right place and it was the right jersey. They wouldn't give you another jersey. You're only trading jerseys, you know. But these cheap blankety-blanks were not doing that. But every employee of the Baltimore Ravens, who was passing out the jerseys, according to the photographs provided to me by the Baltimore Sun, was white. And you say, you know, your city has a lot of problems.
Yeah, so it was white Baltimore passing judgment on an African-American, which is what you see in those circumstances. And, you know, I'm a great baseball fan, and the St. Louis Cardinals are certainly an exciting franchise to watch. But I've watched
a long, troubled history.
Right, and I've watched Cardinal games on TV, and this season's been no exception. There's not an awful lot of African-American fans. I mean, it's clearly a place where African-Americans don't feel comfortable.
We've talked about it on this show. Yeah. That the most famous villain against Mr. Jackie Robinson was Enos Slaughter.
Yes.
Who made no bones about it. He didn't want Jackie Robinson on the field and physically assaulted him. That's not just for the movies. It happened. And but by the way, I mean, of course, St. Louis, it's a struggle. It's not that everybody's bad and nobody's good. All kinds of people grew up, exchanged, improved their positions based on the participation of black ball players. You know, it's like I could say in my own life, I fought with schoolyard bullies and idiots. We used to argue race in the schoolyard. I would win arguments by saying Joe Louis over and over. Joe Louis, Joe Louis, Joe Louis. And later, Muhammad Ali, Muhammad. And you need these events. And by the way, you know, when something happens, it's not politically scripted, a sports event, you know, that's when it becomes very telling because not everybody has their talking points all set up.
you know, by the way, there was an obituary this week for an outfielder for the Dodgers named George Schuba. And George Schuba was a teammate of Jackie Robinson in Jackie's first year in professional baseball with the Montreal Royals. Mm. And Jackie hit a three-run homer, and I think in his second at-bat, right, in a game in Jersey City. This was the first game of the season.
In Jersey City, New Jersey. Tough crowd.
And this photographer catches this moment where Robinson is scoring, and Schuba is standing at home plate. He's the next hitter up, and he's shaking Robinson's hand. And Schuba, who was from an immigrant family from Youngstown, Ohio, steel mill union people, probably a member of the steel workers. He said, well, you know, he was my teammate and he had a three-run homer. Of course I was going to shake his hand. He says, I wasn't even thinking about the racial stuff. It was like, you know, that was my teammate. We want to win a game, right?
Yes, that's how you slowly but surely learn things. I once told a school teacher that the reason we won the war was because Joe Louis said God was on our side. she thought I was really one of her brighter students. That gives you an idea of schools I went to. She said, oh, that was so good. But that's the only thing I knew was Joe Louis had said that.
You know Joe Louis had not got a German fighter.
We should tell people. Yes. Tune in 6 o'clock Wednesday to Classical Underground. And Phil, will have probably someone who participated.
Well, we're trying.
With any luck.
We've reached out and we're trying to get
somebody.
And
you will what is it you're going to play?
We'll play an excerpt from the German Requiem by Johannes Brahms. Which I thought was a very appropriate piece of music to be the event where they did this, and then we're going to play the 2-minute YouTube of the Flash Mob, as they call themselves. Or they're hardly a mob. The Flash Singers, how's that? The Flash Singers singing
the Flash Singers.
The Requiem for Mike Brown in the middle of a unscripted moment in the middle of the St. Louis Symphony. You know. Wow. By the way, the one of the musicians on stage. On stage, tweeted her approval.
A musician
sitting in the one of the violinists sitting, just reached into her purse, pulled out her computer, tweeted her approval, went back to playing the music.
If we don't see each other on the little screens that we're carrying in our palm of our hands, we wouldn't notice the people around us. We're looking, say, oh, you must be 2 seats over from me because I see, you know. And then they tweet rather than talk, which tells us deep down how much everybody really loves each other. You remember it was Jean-Paul Sartre said that hell is other people.
I didn't know he said that, but
he
all
did
right,
say that. And
we'll think about that.
I'm going to give him a chance to, of course, correct it. One of the problems of having one quote from somebody is that it gets hung around their neck. and after a while, you don't get to go to them and say, did you say something else before or after the famous quote? And very often, indeed, they did. They said things which mitigating or a slightly different discourse. And we're checking all of our coordinates, and all of them stand up. So we are... We hope that she's merely indisposed at the moment.
The BBC Hour documentary is called Rwanda, The Untold Story. Mm-hmm. And Googling it, the first thing you come up with is about 5 articles from British papers slamming the BBC and slamming the people who are interviewed and speak on the documentary.
I'm really glad you tossed that in. Yeah. I've seen many praising as well. One of the most important comments came from Jonathan Cook, who's based in Nazareth. And he does not like the producer and chief journalist who reported the story, Ms. Corbin, because of reports they've done. But he said, I got to take my hat off to them, because he said they have they've raised a very important question that many people had asked. Jonathan Cook is not following this issue very closely, but like any alert journalist, he had questions in his mind that he wanted answered. So he said the documentary did that for him. There is, of course, a great deal of heat around this matter, but at the core of it, in my opinion, and by the way, this probably will take any detract at all from the questions we will put to Tiffin Dixon, if and when we do locate her. But in my opinion, this has a lot to do with Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you read that to us. It's BBC Two.
BBC Two. It's Rwanda, The Untold Story.
Rwanda, The Untold Story.
And by the way, Blair looks very bad.
Well, that was what I was – exactly.
Yes.
I was coming to that point.
I think that's probably the people attacking the –
Well, nobody has done Mr. Clinton, who would be just as simple and easy a target. Instead, they've played the game with Clinton about how he's really sorry. However
– Well, Blair ain't even sorry.
Blair was not in the driver's seat in the way that the United States was, in the opinion of anybody who's intimately acquainted with the proceedings – and all the arguments have grown up around it. If you all the heat is primarily the majority of the heat is in Washington about the role and stance of the government. But Blair has stood out in the minds of British citizens as somebody who seems, and you could make an analogy with Clinton, to have profited from their role in the public office, really profited, but in a way that is becomes embarrassing. Association with emirs, kings, and clearly in a kind of a role of an apologist. And and many people wanted to know about, you know, after all, many British soldiers died in Iraq, and Blair helped sell. We tend to focus on Bush, but he did have a poodle, they called him, who was right in there and saying, oh, yes, go, go, go. And the British noticed two things. One, it was a lie, but also that the British were not playing a primary part. They were playing a subservient role with Washington. And that really hurts feelings. And then when Blair tried to account for himself, it became really embarrassing. So one of the reasons, my opinion, and we're going to ask Ms. Dixon shortly, but one of my reasons I think this came off is that there's a lack of love in Britain for Tony Blair, and he figures very largely in this program.